to lift the protections on the land. Holland said tribal consultation must be treated as a requirement, not an option, when the federal government is making decisions that could affect tribal communities. In addition to negatively impacting subsistence hunting and fishing activities, the BLM's analysis found that as many as 117 communities could see the loss of a federal subsistence priority on some lands if protections were lifted and the state were to gain ownership. More than half of the state's 227 federally recognized tribes expressed support for maintaining protections. According to conservation group Salmon State, 183 Alaska Native communities are within 50 miles of a D1 land area, and half of all D1 lands in question lie within the range of the Western Arctic caribou herd. Alaska Senators Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan have strongly opposed maintaining D1 protections. The public land order finalizing the decision will be published in the Federal Register. Tribal leaders and California state lawmakers held a press conference to urge President Joe Biden to designate 3 new national monuments in the state. It was held as the State Assembly considers Senate Joint Resolutions 16 and 17, which urged President Biden to use the Antiquities Act to designate the proposed Tzotzitla, Chuckwalla, and Quetzal National Monuments in Northern and Southern California. The resolutions previously passed the State Senate and the Assembly Committee on Water, Parks, and Wildlife. California Native American Assembly member James Ramos says the proposed national monuments would protect lands that have cultural resources and sacred significance to tribes.
It's not just designating a monument. To us as Indian people, it's a way of life and protecting our lives of our ancestors and who we are and for future generations.
Alterina Santianis is secretary of the Torres Martinez Desert Cuya Indians.
We want it to be where our ancestors were able to enjoy it and live in it. And we also want that for the present and for the future generations, where we can also share this with our communities that are in our surrounding areas. We can educate and we can teach about our culture.
I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 29th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Mel Gertoff, Eric Tegadoff, and Suzanne Potter. The producers Annette Newell and our engineers Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Full Omath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I am Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, so now's a great time to join if you'd like to become a member and support our programming. You can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. The elusive Middle East peace, the Ukrainian incursion in Russian territory, and the latest U.S. strategy against China, more nukes and drones. First, the elusive Middle East peace. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's reported acceptance of a proposal for a temporary ceasefire and exchange of prisoners is grossly misleading. He's far from ready for a ceasefire and hostage deal. As the liberal newspaper Haaretz says, Israel prefers retrieving dead hostages to making concessions to rescue the living. Moreover, Israel's negotiating position leaves little room for compromise with Hamas. As reported by the New York Times in mid-August, quote, Mr. Netanyahu has in fact added new conditions to Israel's demands, additions that his own negotiators fear have created extra obstacles to a deal, unquote. Specifically, Israel's latest proposal was that Israeli forces should remain in control of Gaza's southern border. It also showed less flexibility about allowing displaced Palestinians to return to their homes in northern Gaza once fighting is halted. These modifications have led Hamas leaders to refuse to attend further negotiations. Another obstacle to peace arose following Israel's assassination of Ismail Haniyeh, Hamas's political leader in Gaza. The Hamas leadership appointed Yahya Sinwar as his successor, and Sinwar has been at the top of Israel's enemy list for some time as its forces search for Hamas fighters. He is generally considered the architect of the October 7 attack and the key figure in any ceasefire deal. Then there's the increased settler violence in the West Bank and ongoing military actions by the Israeli Defense Forces in Gaza. The head of Shin Bet, Israel's CIA, wrote to Netanyahu that settler violence amounted to terrorism and is, quote, a large stain on Judaism and on all of us. In Gaza, schools and medical facilities remain under Israeli fire, and more Palestinians are being moved into so-called humanitarian zones that are, in fact, subject to attack. And now, in just the last week, we have Israel's intensified fighting in two areas. First, the airstrike against Hezbollah's missile and drone bases in Lebanon. Both sides seem anxious, however, not to escalate further. The other is a major Israeli attack on the West Bank city of Jenin. In short, it's hard to find any encouraging news. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the latest negotiations, without the presence of Hamas, are the last best chance for peace. In that case, expect this war to go on indefinitely. Next, the Ukrainian incursion in Russian territory. After several months of having to defend against Russia's offensive, Ukrainian forces have surprised the Kremlin by seizing several villages in Kursk Oblast, across the border from Ukraine's northeast, forcing thousands of Russians to flee. Suddenly, the Russians have had to move forces into an area that had not been considered a strategic concern. Ukraine is not likely to permanently occupy any Russian territory, but this incursion does put Putin on notice that Russian territory is not off limits. It also, by the way, puts the U.S. on notice that Ukraine won't always accept Biden's red line on Ukraine's war strategy, which President Zelensky of Ukraine calls naive. Should there be a ceasefire and war settlement, Ukraine may think it can trade prisoners of war and territory it seizes in return for eastern Ukraine territory seized by Russia. At the least, the Russians find themselves suddenly on the defensive. As one military analysis puts it, quote, the current Ukrainian incursion poses significant threats to Russian military operations in Ukraine and Putin's regime stability and demands a response. It will likely expand the Kremlin's consideration for what type of Ukrainian operations are possible along the border. Russia's prolonged treatment of the international border area as a dormant front line is a strategic failure of imagination, unquote. Putin's embarrassment and concern are evident in his appointment of Alexander Bortnikov, the head of Internal Security Services, the FSB, to lead Russia's defense in Kursk. Putin would normally have relied on the chief of the general staff of the Russian armed forces, General Valery Gerasimov. The appointment may yet pay off if Russian forces are able to withstand their Ukrainian incursion without having to move experienced troops away from their advances in the east. But even if those forces are not sent to Kursk, Ukraine may score a win. As Serge Sheman writes in the New York Times, quote, Ukraine's move into Kursk highlights the inherent contradiction in Mr. Putin's propaganda, which portrays the conflict as a proxy war against Western powers trying to deny Russia its destiny, and one in which a calm, united, and prosperous Russia is certain to prevail. But that illusion falls apart once Ukrainian forces have succeeded in slicing into Russia and forcing tens of thousands of Russians to flee their homes, unquote. In a word, Putin's image as a man always in control has been damaged. The latest U.S. strategy against China, more nukes and drones. Every 4 years, the president's intelligence community updates the Nuclear Employment Guidance, the highly classified strategy paper governing the use of nuclear weapons. This year's paper, according to news sources, seeks to take account of important changes in Russian, Chinese, and North Korean nuclear capabilities, including the possibility of a joint attack on the U.S. Vladimir Putin's nuclear threats in the Ukraine war, Xi Jinping's push for a larger and more diverse nuclear arsenal, and Kim Jong-un's buildup of his country's nuclear weapons have all influenced the new strategy paper. Such strategy papers typically talk in terms of worst cases and do not consider diplomatic strategies for offsetting them. In other words, the papers reflect Pentagon thinking, not the State Department's. They consequently move discussion in the direction of adding to the U.S. nuclear inventory, not just with more weapons, but with weapons that are more usable in more varieties of contingencies. When it comes to defending Taiwan, however, the Pentagon is probably as cautious as the Chinese on the mainland about the weapons it would deploy. One report is that the preferred Pentagon strategy is a huge swarm of drones that would flood the Taiwan Strait and buy time for U.S. forces to muster. Turn the Taiwan Strait into an unmanned hellscape, in the words of Indo-Pacific Command Chief Navy Admiral Samuel Papero. That hellscape might also work against Taiwan's defense, since the Chinese also are capable of swarming drones, and they have a naval force equal to the U.S. if measured by the number of ships. In other news, China is resettling villagers in border outposts. Over the last several years, the Chinese government has been systematically moving villagers to more up-to-date new communities at strategic locations along its very lengthy border. A New York Times investigation using satellite imagery has determined that these border guardians, as Xi Jinping calls them, are designed like a great wall to establish a Chinese presence in remote areas, often disputed by bordering countries. Thus, for example, quote, the mapping reveals that China has put at least one village near every accessible Himalayan pass that borders India, as well as on most of the passes bordering Bhutan and Nepal. The satellite data has also determined that these new border villages have also been established in the northwest, bordering Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Kazakhstan, and in the south, bordering Vietnam and Myanmar. The purpose of these new villages may be threefold. One, to protect against the activities of opposing military units, such as India's, as well as separatist groups in Xinjiang. Two, to act as a kind of tripwire, triggering the dispatch of Chinese military or police units where trouble appears. And three, to strengthen China's claim to disputed territory, which is especially the case with India. A positive development in U.S.-China relations, a negative one in China-Japan relations. On the positive side, Reuters reports that China will begin adding controls and financial regulation to the production of three chemicals used to make fentanyl. The White House called the move a valuable step forward, and it's good news for the Biden administration since Republicans have charged that China is subsidizing fentanyl production. On the other hand, a Chinese intelligence gathering plane has caused a flare-up of relations with Japan, as it violated Japanese airspace for the first time ever. The violation, said Japan's chief cabinet secretary, is not only a serious violation of our country's sovereignty, but also a threat to our safety, and we consider it utterly unacceptable, unquote. Japan scrambled fighter jets to ward off the Chinese plane, which very briefly circled near disputed territory in the East China Sea. Three updates on democracy abroad. In Venezuela, Maduro's crackdown continues. In Thailand, the daughter of a former leader takes office. And in Japan, the prime minister suddenly resigns. Writing for The Nation, Alejandro Velasco calls to mind attempts by the U.S. to undermine Venezuela's government, first under Hugo Chavez and now Nicolas Maduro, sometimes with false charges of election fraud. But this time is different, he says. Proof of the opposition's win is incontrovertible, including Maduro's refusal to reveal election data and abandonment of Maduro by Latin American countries that have supported him in the past, such as Brazil and Mexico. But the best evidence of Maduro's illegitimacy is the protesters, Velasco writes. These protests began in areas where Chavismo has long held sway, in the barrios and popular sectors at the heart of Chavez's political project. To date, clashes with security forces have claimed nearly 24 lives and led to more than 1,000 arrests, unquote. That figure has now risen to around 2,400. Reuters reports that the Maduro government has investigated opposition leaders for allegedly inciting the military to commit crimes. A law tightening rules on NGOs has been passed, and state employees allegedly espousing pro-opposition views have been forced to resign. The United States has recognized Edmundo González as the election winner, urged Mexico, Colombia, and Brazil to take the lead in getting Maduro to step down, and offered Maduro amnesty. The European Union is the latest to weigh in, urging him to publish and independently verify the voting records. Sanctions remain in place, but no new ones have been announced. Various countries have offered to mediate, but Maduro seems determined to prevail by force. So far, any more direct intervention against him seems unappetizing. And to make his removal even more difficult, the Supreme Court of Venezuela has validated his victory in a decision that cannot be appealed. Government prosecutors have now summoned González to explain his, quote, disobedience in posting details of the election results. In Thailand, Prime Minister Sureta Thavisin was dismissed on August 14 by the Constitutional Court for a breach of ethics in appointing to his cabinet a former lawyer who was briefly imprisoned 16 years ago. Thavisin becomes the fourth prime minister in the last 15 years to be dismissed by the court. You might say that this is karmic retribution, since Thavisin had prevailed just weeks earlier in getting a constitutional court ruling that the Move Forward Party and its popular leader, who had won election, would be prevented from taking office. Now, the 38-year-old daughter of former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra has been elected to the position. Pathethorn Shinawatra is expected to follow the lead of her father, who has just proposed a very unusual way to stimulate the economy, a digital handout. He would give 50 million Thai citizens 10,000 baht of credit, about $290, via a smartphone application to spend locally within 6 months. Household debt in Thailand is extremely high, and economic growth is anemic, accounting for this fairly radical approach. And in Japan, Prime Minister Kishida Fumio made a surprise announcement in mid-August. He will be stepping down in September, exactly 3 years after taking office. Faced with very low public support in polls, 25% in August, and a political slush fund scandal, Kishida decided to save the Liberal Democratic Party from further erosion of support. The easiest way to clearly show that the LDP has changed is for me to step aside, he said. The LDP, Japan's leading party for most of the post-war years, will now have an election for a new leader who will then be a candidate to succeed Kishida. Finally, the Pacific Island nation of Kiribati voted on China ties. Kiribati, with a population of around 130,000, voted on whether to extend the long-lasting government of President Taneti Maamao. The electoral campaign was dominated by the rising cost of living, rising sea levels, and questions about the benefit of deeper ties with China. Maamao has tied his fortunes to Chinese development aid. China's ambassador gave a warm public endorsement to Maamao, a rather unusual intervention. But his rule has led to inflation of consumer prices and, Reuters reports, concerns that closer China ties have fueled what one Kiribati president described as creeping authoritarianism. One evidence of that is the invitation in a secret agreement to Chinese police advisors to visit and train Kiribati's police. That's exactly what happened in the Solomon Islands, leading to strong U.S. and Australian protests. Rumors abound that the next step will be a Chinese satellite tracking station on the island. President Maamao was reelected, so we'll see about that. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening and take good care.
Cable News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up on Labor Day, it's the 23rd annual Hands Across the Bridge event connecting Oregon and Washington in celebration of addiction recovery. Thousands of residents from Oregon and Southwest Washington will be gathering at the Interstate Bridge to observe the annual Hands Across the Bridge event. It started in 2001, and the festivities begin on Monday, September 2nd at 10 a.m. To learn more, I spoke with Brenda P., a volunteer with the event.
My name is Brenda P., and I am a woman in long-term recovery.
So tell me a little bit about Hands Across the Bridge. What is that organization all about?
Well, our mission is to build leadership in the community by inspiring people to challenge the stigma of addiction by speaking out on recovery-related issues. What that means is that we go and we celebrate our community of recovery, and we work towards bringing the community from the problem of addiction and bringing it into the solution of what recovery is to a lot of people. We try to destigmatize what addiction is and put it in the form of recovery, because there's a lot of us that are celebrating recovery, and we want to share that with the community, because it is for every person, every family, every community.
When did you start to get involved with Hands Across the Bridge?
It has been going, this will be the 23rd year, me being in my 20th year of recovery. I have celebrated with this event from day one. So we have different speakers. We have different events that promote recovery, where people get to show their faces of hope when they were in their addiction, and the hope of recovery and what it brings now with who they are now as a person because of the changes that recovery has brought to their lives. It just entails this entire community coming together, and enough for a lot of us to keep coming back, because we bring that community of hope to others. So the more we share, the more we show the outreach, and the more we put the message out there, it allows everybody to know that recovery is for everyone, for every person, every community.
Well, you mentioned the event that you're holding on Labor Day. What can you tell me about that?
We will meet down there. The team will be down there early, making sure we're set up. The event starts at 10 a.m. We will have several booths, several vendors. We will have Narcan training, which will assist in the recovery process in helping those in that area of recovery. We have amazing speakers. At the end of our actual event down at Esther Short Park, we all walk. I get emotional about this part. Woof. We walk on the bridge and we join hands, connecting Oregon to Washington. And that is a symbol of us connecting together and standing together for our recovery. And it's showing to all those cars that are driving across that bridge that we are out there and we are promoting recovery, because it has been stigmatized for too long. Mental health has been stigmatized for too long. We want to share that message of hope that anyone can access recovery. So it's a really big deal.
Yeah. Are there people that you've met in the past doing this event every year?
Yes. There's longtime people. It was originated by Patty Kratz, who is no longer with us. And it's been just carried over by different leaders in our recovery community. The team that we're on with this year, they're amazing. They're passionate about recovery. They have compassion for people, no matter what area these people come from in life. And that's why we reiterate that theme of every person, every family, and every community, because we open up recovery for anyone. It's not segregated or labeled to just one person. We want everyone to know that there is the possibility of them to have a life in recovery as well.
You touched on this some about the importance that community plays, but I'm wondering if we can address that a little bit more, especially because, you know, dealing with substance use disorder can be so isolating for folks.
Yes, exactly. That's why we do these big giant events. You can come and you can be there, and you can just, you know, be there as yourself. You're not labeled as anyone or anything. A lot of our community is full of people that need the recovery. Our daughters, our sons, moms, dads, coworkers, friends, sometimes people that we don't know that are in need of this of recovery. I need recovery because I'm in it. And that is a blessing, and that's what it does. My sharing message of hope through these events, through your radio station, through the newspapers, by standing on that bridge and coming together as a whole, we are sharing that message with anyone who might need it. They're going to see all these people, hundreds and hundreds and thousands, I'm not sure how many, of people that come and gather to do this. That there is giving the message that our community is working together to share this message and that they can do it too.
What do you hope folks take away from this event if they choose to attend?
I think that having the belief that they can do it too. Because, you know, addiction is, again, stigmatized. It is labeled as this thing, as this bottom, as this you're never going to get out of it kind of thing. But you can look at people that are going to be at this event, that are on our committee, that we all came from a place, and we are all in recovery now. And so with that, it gives hope. It gives hope that they can achieve a new life. They can be members of society and, you know, work towards being part of the community as well. And then at one point, they're going to be on a committee. They're going to be helping doing Narcan training. They're going to be that message of hope for someone else, because we continue to share that recovery is for every person, every family, every community.
You mentioned some misconceptions and myth busting, you know, of ideas that are out there about the recovery community or what it means or what it looks like. Are there other ones that come to mind?
It's just such a great need in our society today. And, you know, like you said, for the people that do feel lost and do feel alone, if we don't do our part in going out and sharing this message of hope and sharing that, by speaking out on recovery-related issues, that wouldn't be doing anything for the community that needs this hope. And so we want to take the community problem and turn it into a community solution. And so it's about moving forward as opposed to staying in the past or staying stagnant. It's about taking what we've learned, what we have now, moving forward with it, and changing that to make that available for anybody who wants it. And not everybody's going to want it, but we are going to plant that seed in somebody. And even if it's one person, that seed is implanted. And that is the future of tomorrow in our recovery world.
If our listeners are interested in learning more about the Hands Across the Bridge event, what's the best way for them to do that?
We do have a Facebook page. It is just one word, Hands Across the Bridge. So if you type that in, the @ Hands Across the Bridge, or email at handsacrossthebridgeinfo.com, and either one of those. You can find me on Facebook, and I will, I'll be open to any questions or assisting anyone in information in getting down there. And any of our committee members, if it's something I can't answer, we are such a great team, and we are all so excited for this event, and, we're ready to go share this message and just show the whole community that it is for anybody.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up? Anything we didn't get to touch on?
Following the actual Hands Across the Bridge event will be the Hands Fest, which is a big party of with a bunch of recovery people, and it'll be live music, food, vendors, a whole bunch of stuff. So we carry it all into the early evening time, and see you on the bridge.
Would you mind giving us those event specifics one last time?
The Hands Across the Bridge event starts at 10, typically ends around 1 o'clock, shortly after there. And fest, sorry, is following with live music, live bands, vendors, food, just a recovery, same purpose, you know, bringing the community together, showing recovery that need it, that we can have fun, and that life is good, and we have the opportunity to do something different. So try to do a lot of different events as such that will draw in the community, because who doesn't love music?
Well, Brenda, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me about it.
I appreciate you taking the time for working with us and sharing the message with us.
That was Brenda P., a volunteer with Hands Across the Bridge, an event that is coming up on Monday, September 2nd. Thousands of residents from Oregon and Southwest Washington will be gathering at the Interstate Bridge to observe the annual event. Hands Across the Bridge celebrates addiction recovery. Festivities are beginning at 10 a.m. on both sides of the bridge, meeting in the middle, of course. That's the Hands Across the Bridge event. You've been listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Thanks for listening.
KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.